Okay, so then we'll just dive in. So what I kind of argued the first couple days is that when we talk about a theology of anything, what we're really talking about is a way of knowing God, right? So it's the Greek word theos coupled with logos is really the study of God, or how do you know God, come to know God. If we're going to talk more just lay level, that's spiritual growth, right, is kind of the language we'd use about knowing God or knowing God better. If we were to talk more philosophically, we would talk about epistemology. Epistemology is the discipline within philosophy on how do we know things and how can we trust the things that we think we know. And so there's an epistemic quality to justice. The justice is one of the ways in which we come to know God better. So what I said was that there's a symmetry that if we study God, we come to find that we learn a lot about justice. And if we study justice, we come to find that we learn a lot about God. And so there's kind of this interesting symmetry there. In fact, it's I think it's important because we tend to break into that discussion very much along kind of party lines. So there's left and right. And I tend to find that people on the left talk a lot about justice, but don't always talk as much about Jesus. And people on the right are very, very, very afraid of the justice conversation because they feel like it's going to minimize Jesus. In fact, I was in Philadelphia at one of the justice conferences and went to an evening gathering after one of the nights. It was a kind of a fundraiser being held in a hotel suite by one of my friends. A guy by the name of Jeremy Courtney, who works in Iraq, is still there with his family and his little kids in the Kurdish area of Iraq. It's just, you know, so reading their reports are pretty unbelievable. But he was holding this kind of gathering, and he had about 30 to 45 pastors and evangelical leaders up there, and they were kind of doing this really loose, he was facilitating it incredibly well, this very loose kind of dialogue with a couple people up front facing everyone, but then everyone else facing them and kind of involved in this dialogue. My wife and I came into the back of the room. We were between things. It's about 10 o'clock at night. We went into the back and we're leaning against the wall and kind of there because Jeremy had asked us to come, and we were only going to stay for a little bit and then we were going to slip out. But while we were there, and they'd been talking now for a good while, this young evangelical pastor raises his hand and he says, hey, all this justice stuff is great and all, but at the end of the day, I want Jesus, not justice. Or I want Jesus more than justice. Or something very close to that. And everybody kind of hummed and hawed and like amened and, you know, kind of nodded in agreement because it was the quintessential Sunday school answer, right? You know, this is great, but at the end of the day, it's I want Jesus, not justice. And I got really disturbed. My body language, I can't hide it. I'm pretty transparent, you know. And so I'm just squirming on the back wall. And so my buddy Jeremy's all the way at the other end of the room, and he can see me. No one else can see me. But so he sees me squirming, and he's kind of, there's people with their arms raised, and he kind of takes a couple people and gets the responses. And the whole while he's watching me, and then he kind of just forces it back to me. And he's, Ken, what do you think, you know? And so I just kind of unloaded with my thoughts, you know, what was in my mind. And I kind of just vomited for about 6 minutes, shut it down. And then we had to sneak out right away. And so, you know, someone came up to me later and was like, were you mad? No, I wasn't mad. We just had to leave. But what I said was this. And so follow me here because it sounds technical, but it's not very technical. But what that gentleman was bringing up was a category fallacy. And I think I taught you the other day that in Christianity, we love to create false dichotomies. We love to create either ors. It makes us feel good. It makes us feel powerful. But it always messes things up. It's a category fallacy. It splits two things apart that can't be split apart. And when you split it apart, you can now choose one. Whereas when they were an amalgam, you couldn't really choose one. the idea of choosing didn't make sense. So here's the argument I put forward in that room in Philadelphia. I said that in philosophy, we make a distinction between substances and properties. Okay? And it's a real simple one, but substances are the things that have properties. Properties are the things that are had. Okay? So people are substances, and we have properties. So I have the property of being 5'10". I have the property of being the son of John and Bonnie Weitzma, the property of being an ENTJ on the Myers-Briggs. I have the property of being a father to four daughters. But I can go on and on and talk about things that constitute who I am. I'm the sum total of all those different properties. Does that make sense? Now, of the properties I have, if we play with it a little bit further, you're going to find that some of those properties are non-essential. As difficult as it might be, if I went to Afghanistan and got my leg blown off right now, I would still be Ken Weitzman. Does that make sense? I mean, it would be incredibly traumatic, but I would still be who I am. But if you tried to talk about me without reference to being intuitive, or to talk about me as being a non-intuitive person, you'd begin to create a weird tension, because that's my most dominant characteristic in terms of personality. Or if you were to start trying to talk about Ken Weitzma as not being the son of John and Bonnie Weitzma, or as not having the property of being a father, you actually wouldn't be talking about me anymore. You'd be talking about somebody that doesn't exist, or really making a butchery of who I am. But those are essential attributes. Even if all my kids, heaven forbid, would die, I would always have been the father of those girls. And if you were to try and take that out of what makes me, you'd be missing an essential component of who I am. Does that make sense? Okay. So the interesting thing we find is that Jesus, as a substance who has properties, that justice is a pretty significant thing. So justice is the footstool of God. Scripture also says it's the scepter by which he rules. So Jesus is the king who came. I made the argument the other day from Isaiah 51 that he's literally the right arm of God. God says, my own arm will break in and work salvation for my people, because I looked and there was no justice and nobody to intervene. That Jesus in the incarnation is really the inbreaking, the right arm of God to work restorative justice, to bring things back into alignment with God's creation. So Jesus literally was coming to be the justice of God. That was his mission, his mandate. His heart is patterned that way. We made the argument out of Matthew 25 that there's this identity between Jesus and the people he loves, such that if we do things for those people, it's as if we're doing it for Jesus himself, that he identifies so deeply with the vulnerable or the oppressed or the poor. His sphere of concern extends to them. So Jesus's mission was justice. His heart is patterned that way. The mandates he gave us, the command to love, really reflect his heart for justice, that things would be the way they're supposed to be, and that would reach to everyone, the orphan, the widow, the alien, the poor. And so we begin to see that there's something really interesting, that Jesus as the justice of God, that justice is an essential attribute of Jesus. Does that make sense? So if you were to try, just think of it now, try and make reference to Jesus or picture or conceive of Jesus as if justice is something that's not a part of his essential attributes. And when I'm talking about justice here, I'm not talking about punitive justice. I'm talking about the broad definition of justice that includes mercy and the commands to love and grace and reconciliation and all of the positive things we talked about in our definition of justice. So try and conceive of talking about Jesus without reference to what makes Jesus who he is. In fact, we would have to submit to God if God was a tyrant. But all throughout Scripture, the worship that God calls for, he often calls for because of his characteristics. Being a good God means that I can ask for and deserve your worship and your adoration. And Jesus says the fact that I'm a good shepherd, which means that I should have this position, this lofty position, is measured in the health of my flock. Look at my flock and you'll know that I'm a good shepherd. And because I'm a good shepherd, then you can trust my leadership. So the idea here is that what this young pastor was saying was simply that we're going to treat Jesus as an English word, spelled J-E-S-U-S, on a piece of cardboard. Does that make sense? And we're going to treat justice as a English word, J-U-S-T-I-C-E, on a piece of cardboard. And when you have two English words on two different pieces of cardboard, now you can evaluate them for their grammatical loftiness or worth and say, well, if those two words are on two separate pieces of paper, which one do we prefer? We prefer Jesus, not justice. When we're talking about the man, Jesus, we realize that we can't separate out justice, that Jesus is the sum total of all of the attributes that make him up, with justice being one of the chief attributes that define him. And so another way of saying it is there's never been a time in the history of the world where Jesus was, but justice wasn't. Does that make sense? So this guy was saying something that sounded so spiritual, but it was actually very nonsensical. If we understand Jesus, then we understand that justice is a necessity that goes along with Jesus. And so what this gentleman should have been saying is, because justice is such a defining characteristic of Jesus, I'm really passionate about making sure that when we talk about justice, that we let Jesus and Jesus' teachings saturate our understanding of justice so that it can be the most robust understanding or theology of justice possible. But to say at the end of the day, I want Jesus, not justice, was a nonsensical thing. Does that make sense? Okay. So this whole idea of a theology is incredibly important because we have to think deeply about things so that we understand that things aren't just words on cardboard, English letters on cardboard. They're actually deeper realities going on here, and they feed into a holistic understanding of ourselves and our relationship with God. Any questions right there? I mean, I used the word philosophy, I think, once in that whole little story. That might have just thrown a lot of people, but any questions on that? Yeah. So it's a big question, and I'd say let's define it first by how we get it wrong, okay? And we get it wrong by giving the impression that we don't care about justice, right? So it's like you care about justice, but for, in my opinion, the wrong reasons, because you don't understand Jesus. And so I'm now going to beat up on justice because you're getting it wrong. And what I really end up looking like is a non-compassionate, unloving, uncaring, non-justice person. And how is that going to take somebody that understands that justice matters, but just is a bit confused or foggy on things? How is it going to take that person and help them understand Jesus better? You know, Jesus says, they're going to know you are my disciples by your love. Which means taking an unloving posture is probably a bad idea. And I think oftentimes we've ended up that in that place as conservatives, is we beat up on social justice for a lot of capitalistic and free market reasons without ever saying that we affirm the dignity of persons. We just think there's a better way to honor them. With creating opportunity and, you know, blah, 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 blah. So the first thing we have to do is not go to the other extreme and say, you care about justice, but I have some fundamental disagreements with you, and I'm going to end up looking like I don't care about justice. No, I care about I have to care about justice. But let's have a discussion on policy and see what's going to bear the most fruit over a long period of time. Or let's talk about why you're motivated for justice, because at the end of the day, justice is rooted in the worth or the value of human persons from a theistic standpoint, because people are made in the image of God, okay? So they have that fundamental worth. What is driving your desire for justice if you have no worldview that says people matter, you know? So I mean, you have that empathy and you want, but philosophically or theologically, why should I care about your feelings that people matter? Like, ground that, you know? And let me show you how Jesus grounds that, that everyone has been created by a loving God and endowed with significance and worth, and that God even commands us to treat them in such a way. Let me show you how I get that. But we can't show them how we get our justice impulse if we don't first care about justice. And that was the great problem of the last 100 years, that off of the social gospel movement, we had this great, what John Stott called the great, I just dropped it, it'll come back to me in a minute, but we had this great divide come up, and the conservatives took the proclamation of Jesus, and the liberals tended to take the hands and feet or the service or the justice or the love, and they kind of occupied these two different spheres. And what you see is, in any fight, you always go to two extremes. So watch any boxing match. In between rounds, you'll hear the bell. And just think how funny it would be if they put two stools in the middle of the ring and the guys sat back to back. You know what I mean? Like, when you're in a fight, it pushes you to extremes, opposite corners. And that's really what happened in the last 100 years. Now, it doesn't mean that every conservative was unloving or every liberal was, you know, but by and large, the generalizations were mapped out along these lines. And so the first thing that I think has been happening the last decade or so, and I think needs to continue to happen, is that conservatives need to be able to show that heart of compassion and an understanding of justice if they hope to be in this conversation and speak to maybe some of the deficiencies in theology. The problem has been is that a lot of people that have been in the justice space and understand it really well, for them, conservatives are new to the game, and it's like, you might have charity, like you might write good checks and care about poor people over there, but you don't really understand the nuance of race and structures and systems and privilege. And so until conservatives can come in and say, no, I understand those things. I can be in this conversation, but now let me ask you some questions. We can't really lead, right? Does that make sense? So I think that's where I would say is we really have to, frankly, that's where a lot of the stuff I've been doing has been aimed at. Yeah. Well, and that happens. But again, how's the Christian voice gonna push back on that? From the moral majority forward, the Christian voice was always on a few issues with what we were against, was by and large kind of the way it was framed out. And we still, by and large, see instances of where we end up without kind of equality, or where the law is being changed or rewritten to disfavor Christians in certain areas. And again, until we occupy the spaces where we do have rights or opportunity, until we use our privilege and our wealth and different things in a more broad-based kind of just way, it's really going to be hard to win the moral mandate or power to really be in those rooms and say, hey, wait a second, what's really going on here? So we need to know and understand what's going on there, and I guess what I'm saying is those gaps, we really need to know and understand what we can be doing in those gaps and what we should be doing in those gaps, so that we can be in that conversation if and when we're able. Let me move us along real quick, and please keep raising your hands. Again, it's a dialogue. But here's my problem. I think conservative Christians tend to go to the political hot buttons first with regard to justice, and we haven't really cultivated a deep understanding of biblical justice, and then been broken over the ways we're not measuring up to that. And we want to keep running to the fight, and I think there's a whole lot of work and repentance that we need to do over here. A lot could be said there. If there's any one chapter I'd want you to read in my book, it would be the chapter on consumerism. And if you really look back at it, there's this interesting thing that happened after World War II, where we had a superheated economy. I mean, just think of the the output coming off of World War II, and we had a whole lot of people in the workforce, right, that had never been there before. And so how do you not all of a sudden, after the government is spending all this money kind of on the war effort and bonds are being bought and all that, when that all of a sudden curtails, how do you not fall back into the Great Depression again? That was, you know, recent memory for everybody, right? And so what was actually thought through and implemented was this idea that we need to keep people buying and we need to feed the economy so that we can keep going forward. And so a lot of things were created that were purposely meant to be in the 2 to 4 year lifespan, electronics and other things, throwaway disposable kind of goods, so that we would become a consumer society. Because only a consumer society can drive an economy at that level. If you go to China right now, China always, I think it's either 3 years or 5 years, they have they have a mandate every so often, and they rewrite the rules of their economy, what they want, and it's all top down in China. I mean, it's all state controlled. So they're able to just rewrite everything and say, this is what we're going to do. And one of the things that they have in their current plan is to become consumeristic, to make their people become quasi like Americans that would have consumeristic values like that. And so that's like one of their stated goals. Why? Because as they're emerging as this kind of global economy, they need to get their people cycling through and spending, because it's the thing that floats that whole deal. But to all that to say, right or wrong, up, down, left, right, doesn't matter. Go back and look at how America became America, the one we know, with the commercials we have, with the spending habits we have, with the products that we've become used to or patterned to. Well, there's a whole lot that we were shaped by and that we now live out. And if you talk to people that come from other countries, they'll see it. I mean, the minute they show up here, they'll see it, okay? And until we explore some of these areas and say, Jesus had a lot to talk about that. You know, I've got too much. Let me go build bigger barns, you know, or, you know, let me go do this with my wealth, or let me go do that. And Jesus is saying, listen, you need to learn to be rich toward God. And this is, you know, this is, I'm a part of this too. So, you know, whenever you point the finger at other people, there's three fingers pointing back at you, you know, that whole deal. But I think there's a lot for conservative, Bible-believing Christians to look at and say, I have to be broken somehow in this, and I have to learn to live out some different values in this if I'm gonna earn the right to really have that voice to speak into systems and structures and policy. But there's a whole lot of room that we're neglecting kind of in our conversation. Yeah, last question, then we're gonna get to creativity. Yes, the problem with social justice, I think, is worse than that, right? So the problem with socialism, said Margaret Thatcher, is that sooner or later you run out of other people's money. Okay, so the idea here is that there is no wealth creation mechanism in socialism. There is no wealth creation mechanism, right? So we're getting into economic theory and everything else and governance theory, but nobody, I think, wants out-and-out socialism in America. We all want some kind of hybrid. And frankly, none of us want to go back to the late 1800s with the robber barons and everything else, where there's absolutely no control on business, you know, where you can exploit children and you can do whatever you want. So nobody wants the extremes. So when we paint other people into the extremes, it's a bit like we're missing the point. So there's a range in here. But the more socialistic we get, the more problematic it becomes from a long-term sustainability level. And the more we get over here where we take all the reins off with such a huge economy, we begin to miss the natural propensity for sin in people, and that there always has to be checks and balances and accountability, because people can take advantage of people, or people in powerful places can wreck a whole country's economy for selfish reasons. So somewhere in here, there's this conversation. But with social justice, and again, you're using it for social programs, Justice, social justice, at its definition, means justice in the social arena. Orphans and widows and poor and all that. Your theory or strategy or platform for enacting social justice is where most Christians are reacting to the left. Okay? It's not justice in the social sphere is wrong. It's that we don't like the way it's being done. We think that there's problems with that. And instead of saying social justice bad, Republican, you know, I'm an independent, so I can play this game all day long, right? Republicans have to say, no, yeah, social justice does matter. Inner city, urban, poor does matter. Education and inequity does matter, okay? I have some disagreements with your strategy for enacting it and think that long-term that's not the best way to do it, which forces you to have what? Well, something to say, if I disagree with this, that means I have the burden of what? An alternative that's better. The problem with most on the extreme right is we're going to beat this up, and then we're going to say, and now the conversation's going to switch to, I mean, we're not even going to talk about justice anymore. We're going to beat up on this bad, and then we're going to go talk about a different platform that doesn't really say much about justice. And so if we're going to say this is a bad strategy for enacting social justice, I actually have to care about social justice and say, I've got a better thing to offer. And it certainly can't be unbounded capitalism. Okay? That's not the answer to justice problems. It can involve free markets or whatever else, but we have to be knowledgeable enough to get into those conversations and say, I have some problems with social justice. Here's why. I don't think it'll work long term. And here's my offering to say that there's a better way. And so it's become way too easy in the Glenn Beck world to use social justice as just a shorthand to beat up on the left and then kind of be a proponent of right policy. But justice loses in that somehow. Like, we have to say that, yeah, no, the poor still matter. And this party, if I don't like how your party's handling it, my party has to do better. All right, so creativity. Good discussion, fun discussion. Hopefully some of this is showing you just the conversation is valuable in some way. And we don't typically have these conversations in churches. Typically in churches, the sermon is simply this. It's there's a passage of scripture. It basically talks about this kind of big idea. I'm going to abstract that, and this isn't wrong, but when we do this week after week, and that's all we do, right, it basically talks about the need for forgiveness, and so I can extract that principle out, and I can universalize it, and now I can apply that principle to you in the context and where you're at. This is biblical preaching, but I'm not trying to beat up on biblical preaching, but that's the formula. What happened in that context? What's the universal principle? Now, how do I apply this universal principle into today's context? And then here's three ways that you can go do that application. And it becomes very self-helpish. Oh, I need to be a more forgiving person. I'll be more liked by God. I'll have a better life. And here's three ways I can go forgive someone today, forgive someone tomorrow, forgive someone the day after tomorrow. And then next week, it's going to be a new principle in three ways to do that. And after the course of 2 years, I've now had 104. And after 10 years, I've had how many? 500 or 5,000? I don't know. But my problem isn't that I don't need more principles. My problem is that I can't even do the ones that I'm aware of already. Right? That my problem is one of repentance and forgiveness. My biggest problem is one of repentance and forgiveness and trust. That day in and day out, if I seek God's leading, that it's going to scare the heck out of me, but somehow I got to follow it. And that in all of these principles, I can be getting these great Christian self-help things without really gaining knowledge, deep historical, theological knowledge into understanding kind of what's in front of me. And that's what I loved about Paul's. Paul would move in and out of categories left and right and even shame people in 1 Corinthians. I'm telling you this to your shame. Like, when was the last time you heard a preacher do that, right? Let me talk to you about right politics or left politics to your shame. You know, like, it's not going to go well. But somehow I pray for a deeper, richer, educational, theological kind of framework or discussion to come into the church. We've been anti-intellectual for too long. The last 100 years, we've been anti-intellectual, and I think that we have to get out of that. So to that end, I started thinking about creativity. And I realized that there's something really interesting about creativity that's very much like that justice thing. I study God, I learn about justice. I study justice, I learn about God. That's really interesting. There's a symmetry there. And all of a sudden, I took that same symmetry, and I ended up in this verse, Genesis 1:27. You talk about it a lot when you talk about justice, because we are created, men and women, in the image of God, which means we have this center of gravity, this dignity, this spark, divine spark, that means that we have to treat each other in a certain kind of way, right? That's where justice gets going. So human rights, by the way, this is that same problem again between left and right. Human rights is the language we use, right? But human rights imply human what? Responsibilities. If I have a right to claim against you, thou shalt not steal. I have the right to not be defrauded of my property. You have a responsibility to not steal. If you have a right that I would treat you in a certain way, then I have a moral obligation or a responsibility, a human responsibility, to render to you that that which you're due according to your right, your human right, okay? And so human rights and human responsibilities are two sides of a coin, and they go together. You can't have the one without the other, right? When the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was being written, it was the new founded UN right after World War II. League of Nations had been a failure. The U.S., even though it was Woodrow Wilson's plan, by the time he took the ship back from the Treaty of Versailles, and come all the way back and said, I gave away the farm just so I could have this, the Congress voted it down, and we never joined the League of Nations. It's really ironic, and you know, poor Woodrow Wilson, right? But so we never joined the League of Nations, and so when that thing disbanded because it ultimately failed because it couldn't prevent World War II, so it went away, and by the end of World War II, they started talking again about we need this kind of council of countries. And how are we going to make sure it works this time? And everybody knew, well, if it's going to work, it has to have the U.S. involvement. And so they in San Francisco is where the first meetings happened. And then eventually some land in New York was given to build the building because everyone knew if it's going to work this time, not like the failed League of Nations, the U.S. has to be involved. And so the whole thing was built on this idea that this United Nations would come together to preserve universal human rights. And dignity. Well, what are those rights? And so they created a committee to go and draft the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and they appointed Eleanor Roosevelt to chair that committee. Eleanor Roosevelt was widely was revered kind of in global communities. Her husband had just died. She was a politician herself. And so they said, why don't you chair this and bring the parties together and create this Universal Declaration of Human Rights? Really interesting, though, because as they began this dialogue at the very early stages of the Cold War, you had two totally different ways of thinking about this, didn't you? The West was coming and they were talking about rights, rights, rights. Free speech, the right to this, right to that. The East was coming, and what was their kind of centering point? Human responsibility. The communal kind of moral imperative rather than the individual. And so you get this clash. And so in this clash kind of going on, all of a sudden you get finger pointing. And so the West is pointing the finger at the Russians and saying, you're not allowing for what? Free speech. Or you're detaining, you know, the political activists. You're doing all this stuff. And the Eastern Bloc, what was their response to Eleanor Roosevelt and to the Americans? You all are hypocrites. Why? Poor wasn't the first thing they point out. Racism. You still had Jim Crow laws in effect in the South. You still had lynchings. Do you know that there were only two people convicted in America for murder against in the South for murder against a black person from the year 1879 to like 1960 something. Only two white people convicted of first-degree murder against black persons in almost 100 years, right? I mean, I can't fathom the height I can't fathom that. So then you've got these people writing against this. But out of that, you get this Universal Declaration of Human Rights, okay? And the interesting thing is it was always supposed to go with a legal body, a court, an international human rights court, if you will, that was supposed to have the power and the authority to make sure this happened. Okay, the first one happened. Cold War was going forward, and so relations were deteriorating. This second one has languished. By the way, it exists, right? Did you guys read the news yesterday about Cambodia? They finally convicted two upper-level Khmer Rouge leaders with crimes against humanity, and they're going to spend the rest of their life in jail, which might be another year or two. It's been since the 70s. Charles Taylor in Liberia, you know, was drugged to The Hague in the Netherlands and brought before a human rights kind of international court. Does that make sense? It exists, but it doesn't have any mandate. Why doesn't it have any mandate? This really opens up cans of worms, but this is fun. This has a lot to do with homeschooling, because you need to teach your kids this kind of stuff. Why doesn't it have much mandate? What's that? Because the United States and the Soviet Union will never sign on to putting themselves under the authority of an entity or a body outside of their own borders. And I have to admit, the American in me agrees with that. But let's put it this way. There are countries that Henry Kissinger won't travel to. Why? Because there are some people out there that have been agitating for a very long time that he's guilty with the bombing of Cambodia in the Vietnam War and other things, that Henry Kissinger is guilty of crimes against humanity. And there are places where he actually thinks, I don't want to go there because they might grab me and try and detain me. Okay? If we were signed on, then even George Bush could be held, and there are people that still cry for this kind of thing, that he would be under the jurisdiction of an international court. So we have the international, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but we don't have the body that can fully implement that. And like I said, I don't know that I'm saying that's wrong, but the whole program kind of came unhinged when it actually came down to rubber meets the road. There's going to be a body that's going to kind of be a governance that way. So that's interesting thing, but you see this human rights, human responsibilities. But it all gets going because of the image of God in every man and every woman. That we have a right and that others have a responsibility. No God, no image of God, I think you have a really hard time making an argument for rights. That's to your point of when we can get into an apologetics conversation with people and they welcome us in because we show that we have a concern for people, then we can begin to expose some of these flaws in the worldview. Sure, so I'd say... it's going to sound strong, but I think it's completely political reasons. I mean, that's why when you're in a power, you don't put yourself underneath a power that you can't trust. And so it's just human nature, and I don't know that I necessarily disagree with it. The tenor of what you're bringing up, though, has been the tenor of the conversation against social justice for a very long time, and it's really coming from a dispensational theology, or partly dispensational, that says this whole thing is going to hell. And why polish the brass railing on the Titanic? Yes, there's problems. Yes, there are poor. Yes, there's education inequity. But ultimately, we can't fix that or save that or redeem that. We have to realize kind of there's this big battle going on, and we need to make sure that we really fight the right battle, which is kind of saving souls and some of this stuff. And hold on one second. Now, that's a broad generalization, okay? But the the problem is I grew up in a culture where whenever good was done, it was treated with suspicion unless it was a Christian doing it. So a Muslim has a charity. It's like, well, that looks good, but I know it's not really good because that person's a Muslim. And I guarantee you, if we pulled Mount Hermon today, everyone would have, if I put up five examples, Muslim doing this, a Baha'i doing this, a jihadist doing this, if we're honest with ourselves, we're very defensive and we don't want to grant anything kind of to those examples. And there's something incredibly telling about that that I think is dysfunctional, because when Jesus gave the parable of the Good Samaritan, he said, now there was a Muslim who was walking down this road and he did this thing. Now I want you to go love like that Muslim. That would be translating kind of into that's how you would preach it, right? And Jesus was pushing into their definitions and saying, you guys are so tribal or territorial that you can't understand that love is good. 1 Corinthians 13, it's its own end. We don't love for some ulterior motive to win souls. We love because it's the right thing. I can take you to Bible Gateway right now and show you that Jesus was moved with compassion. Not because it was going to lead to some great proclamation, but he was moved with compassion because he was a compassionate being. And he, like his father, are defined by their love. And so I think that the first thing we have to do is decouple our suspicions of do-gooders that don't share our worldview, and realize that when Paul was writing to the Romans and saying, these people do justice even though they don't understand human dignity. And even though they get a lot of things wrong, they in their hearts actually care. But a lot of these people that know the law or talk Bible or are conservatives are having all these debates about other things and walk right by the poor and don't understand the hypocrisy in that. And Jesus is pushing into that, and Paul is pushing into that and saying, we can't have these intellectual debates if we ourselves have first not repented and been broken by the fact that although we have the truth, we so seldom live into it. And we talk about our rights as Christians and being infringed upon by the government. What about the right of a black American not to be arrested wrongfully? And what about the right, you know what I'm saying? And so we have these white middle class evangelical kind of hot buttons. And we've got to learn to not start the conversation there, but to start the conversation with truth and with love, and then begin to understand that the rules have to apply to everyone. And good is good no matter where good is found. That's the definition of good. I mean, good is good. Good doesn't mean bad. Good means good. And if a Muslim is doing good, they're doing good. That's the common good. God sends his rain on the evil and the wicked alike. There's some things that are for all people, not just for the people of God. And we can live into good, and that's still good, even though it's shadowy and we don't understand where it's coming from. And that's why if we understand these things and can get into these conversations, we can help people understand, like, hey, that moral impulse you have here, let me talk to you about the God that is love. But we've for so long always had a pushback and always had a rejoinder and always had a political this and always had a social justice that and always had that we've never actually shown the positive virtue of, yeah, we get it just as much as you do. We get it just as much and we care about those things. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So it's a natural human response. If we think we're against something, to try not to validate any good in it, just watch the evening news. They won't say anything positive about, the other, right? But we're Christians. And truth is truth. And that's what's so radical about Jesus' telling of the parable of the Good Samaritan. Is no rabbi is going to make the hero of his story the archenemy, the Samaritan. And so we gain so much credibility when we're honest and transparent and say, you know what, I feel like at the heart of Christianity it's love, but yet this Muslim who I don't know that at the heart of his faith is love, but this Muslim seems to be loving better than I am. I need to be chastened by that. My Muslim neighbor needs to teach me something. And hopefully, if I'm willing to be teachable to my Muslim neighbor, maybe I'm able to teach them something about worldview and about scripture and about truth. And so there's something about being not afraid enough. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Meaning, ask your questions, push, 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 push. The further you get, you're not going to get further and further away from me. You're going to get closer and closer to me. I can handle all of your questions, your doubts. And when we have that kind of intellectual confidence, then I think we can just appreciate truth wherever it is. And that's where Paul said, listen, these Gentiles, they do the law even though they don't have the law. And you who have the law don't even do the law. So let's back up now and then have this conversation again is kind of what Paul's saying. So I think you're putting your finger on it. That's the human response. We want to objectify the other and generalize the other. And if we're doing that, we're not recognizing the image of God in everybody, and we're doing them a disservice, because objectification and generalization is where all apathy and injustice begins. Let me just read it to you. I apologize if you came to... Yeah, but... I want to read just this list of, so empathy is the heart of it all, right? So here's the Nazis, okay? Because the closer someone gets, if I know your story, I mean, if I know all of the hurts and the pains and the attempts and the, I'm going to have so much grace, because I'm going to go, wow, we all want that. If they just knew, then they would. They might not. It doesn't make my actions right, but at least they can appreciate that I'm doing the best I can, you know. Or I wasn't given much, and blah 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 blah, you know. But so empathy traffics in closeness, seeing the image of God in the other, right? Apathy is all about distance created. So 1933. The first boycott of Jewish shops and businesses, 1934, the removal of the Jews' ability to have health insurance, 1935, the Nuremberg laws remove citizenship from Jews. Now you're not even citizens anymore, and it's illegal for Jews to marry or have sexual relationships with non-Jews. In other words, you can't pollute the bloodlines here. You're other and you're less than. 1938, Kristallnacht, the night of the broken glass. One of the first instances of mass violence against Jews. Thousands of Jews were arrested. Synagogues burned. Jewish businesses are vandalized. So we're going to desecrate your holy places, which is going to lower you, and we're going to destroy your property. Remember life, liberty, property? Okay. We're going to destroy your property because you don't have those same rights. It doesn't matter if we take from you and you go down. Yellow Star is introduced in 1939. We're marking you off as other, objectifying you. 1939, first Jewish ghetto opened in Poland. So remember, life, liberty, property. So we go from property now to liberty, and we're removing or pushing you into these segregated ghettos. By the way, when was the first ghetto created, and who created it? Late 1500s, Jewish ghetto created in Rome by the Catholic Church. So knowing our history, it existed almost unbroken until a brief period when the papacy was out of control, and then when the papacy came back into control, it was reinstituted. So knowing our history, right? Luther's church, if you go to Wittenberg, you go about 100 feet up in the air on the corner of the church, it's got a pig that's being suckled by Jews, and then a Jew smelling the fart of the pig. Sculpture in stone on. Now, he didn't do the sculpture. That was his church, though. It's where he worshipped. So this anti-Semitism, deep, right? But it's pushing away, objectifying the other. And then finally in 1942, you begin getting mass gassing. Why? Because we're going to solve this this Jewish question or the Jewish problem because they're less than human. We can exterminate them like we do with less than human things. What were they called in Rwanda? Cockroaches. Same thing. So objectification and distance is where all injustice lives. What was Jesus doing when he said, here's the parable of the Good Samaritan? Saying, listen, truth doesn't allow for generalizations. We can talk about generalizations of immigrants, right? Well, it's the cartel coming across the border. Guess what? It actually is in places. But it's also the woman in Las Vegas who's cleaning hotel rooms of rich, privileged people on vacation and is getting sexually abused by her boss because he knows she won't report it because of her legal status. So empathy, when I understand justice the way Jesus did, I look at the particular and I look at the story and I go, that matters to me. You know, I don't just look at the kind of distance of it all. And so there's something really significant about being careful that we don't do that left-right intellectual debate where we can always objectify. As Christians, we come down and we say, what is true? What is the story? And what does the love of God mean within this kind of this crack right here? Holy cow. Yeah. Did God intend for this or did I just blow it? Did I just, because I didn't even say anything about creativity. Go ahead. Leave you with that this was fun.
This is, can we meet tomorrow?
Maybe, yeah.
Actually, this is my first time sitting here. I think he's demonstrating creativity. He jumped out of all my categories and stretched online. See how
So I'll give you my thesis statement. Yeah. So let me give you Genesis 1:27. We'll leave on this, and I don't mind meeting tomorrow if there's space for us, because there's actually a lot of really cool stuff on innovation and leadership. But so here's the interesting thing I realized that's a real mind bender. But so here's Genesis 1:27. God created humankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. What is the one thing we know with grammatical certainty is a part of the image of God? When have you ever heard that? The of all the classes I've been to on the image of God and the character of God and all of his loving kindness and patience and long sufferingness and all of the wonderful attributes of God, what is the one thing we know from pure grammatical, logical necessity has to be included in our understanding of the image of God? Let me read this again. God created humankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. So when we are being creative, it's as if we're taking the image of God in us out for a walk. And Dorothy Sayers said this, man is never truly himself except when he is actively creating something. And so when we want to talk, so what I want to do, and if we can meet tomorrow, is to say, how would we redefine our understanding of leadership and influence and how we go about doing our business if we understand that at such a root, deep level, a creative God has made us in his image to be creative in bringing about good. Does that make sense? So, our understanding of what it means to be in relation with God. Absolutely. So let me dismiss you because I promised that I would dismiss you on time. If you got a question or if you're really mad at me, you can stick around. I'll hear it. And then I got nothing to do tomorrow. So if there's a free room, I'll find out. If not, then you'll have to wait for the book to come out.